You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. The funeral processions of nine human rights activists killed in an Israeli assault on an aid flotilla trying to break the blockade of Gaza were held today in Istanbul. Jeremy Bowen was there.
It's over now. Thousands of people there. And they have now gone their separate ways and they've taken the different coffins, I think, back to their homes, towns and villages. I saw, for example, one going back to Diyarbakir, which is right over in the southeast of Turkey, Kurdish area. So they're going from there, they're from all over the country by the looks of things. It was very well attended, a lot of anger, but it was highly political as well. So it wasn't just mourning. You could hear it in the chanting, pro-Hamas, anti-Israel, and chanting as well in favour of what they call resistance.
Right, and eight Turkish nationals and one US national, I see, in this group.
Yes, the local news agency reported a US citizen of Turkish origin. So I think there are people. I mean, I had a long chat, as a matter of fact, with a British Turkish guy, Turkish origin, who was on the boat, and he described how he saw people shot in front of him, shot dead, shot very severely, and now one of the people still in Israel in hospital. And he absolutely denied the allegations that the Israelis have been making that they were a bunch of Hamas terrorist fellow travelers. And I spoke also to a senior person from this NGO, this aid organization, the IHH, which was behind the organization of the flotilla and also was organizing the event today. And he very hotly denied these accusations made by the Israelis that they were somehow jihadist or fellow travelers for mass. He said the Israelis always make those kinds of accusations against people who don't like them.
Yeah, but those claims also come from Turkish officials, don't they, in the past, and from French magistrates and so on. I mean, is there much public examination of the IHH in Turkey?
Well, I think it's becoming controversial. I think the spotlight's going upon them. I mean, you can see, looking at them, I mean, I would say, judging, and I'm in no sense an expert on them, but judging by their appearances, you know, I've spent a lot of time as a foreign correspondent over more than 25 years around aid organizations in all kinds of parts of the world. And they were, you know, they're not quite out of that mold, you might say. You know, there's some quite burly guys who are holding back the crowd. It seemed to me to be, no doubt, they have charitable work. They say they work with the UN and various other organizations. It's clearly a highly politicized organization as well. And plus, it's an Islamist group. The people there were all pious Muslims, no question about that.
Jeremy Bowen there. Well, if you look on YouTube to see what pictures are circulating about the attack on the flotilla, you'll see a lot of short films posted by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. Very little, it seems, posted by anyone else. But there is an increasing chance of getting the other side of the story because people on board the boats have been released now. Amongst them, Irish anti-war activist Fintan Lane, now in Istanbul. I asked first whether he was on one of the boats, or the boat, that came under attack.
All of the boats came under attack by Israeli forces. I was on Challenger 1, not the Turkish ship, but we were also assaulted. We had Israeli Zodiacs come at us from the side, and we were forced to slow down, and the Zodiacs came in and using stun grenades and quite a degree of violence, including the tasering of a journalist, they stormed the boat. We saw Zodiacs approaching the Turkish ship. The Turks were attempting to fend them off using water hoses. As we pulled away, we also saw helicopters moving in towards the top of the Turkish ship. I spoke with some of the people that were on the Turkish ship while in prison afterwards, and since I spoke to them today as well here in Istanbul. And I've been given a very graphic sense of the type of violence they endured. One man showed me bite marks on his stomach from an Israeli dog. Another man spoke of seeing people with bullet holes in their foreheads. It's quite clear that the amount of the violence used against people on that Turkish ship was phenomenal, and that the Israeli army went in, as if they were dealing with a military enemy, they went in full force using live ammunition and quite a degree of violence.
Can you understand why the situation was so different, though, on these different ships? Because the pictures that are on YouTube from the Israeli Defense Forces show the violence going on the Turkish ship, and yet the other ones, on, like the ship you were on, that didn't happen. Why not?
For a start, The Israeli imagery cannot be trusted. They were filming all the time while they were on Challenger 1. We resisted their attempt to board us. We established a barricade on the decking area towards the back of the boat. We locked the sliding glass door to the saloon, and we put a table against it, and we attempted to stop their seizure of the boat. Now, I don't know if they've put that on YouTube, and I don't know if they've put it about the place, but we attempted peacefully to resist their seizure of our boat. But they turned off the camera at various times. For instance, I turned to them and I pointed out that what they were engaged in was the illegal hijack of a boat in international waters, and they just switched the camera off. So what you're seeing is a sanitised, highly edited version of what happened.
Now, I take the point it's edited footage, there's no question about that, but it does show, as these soldiers came down from helicopters on ropes onto the top of their ship, they were beaten.
I don't know whether one or two people fought back. To be honest, it wouldn't surprise me if one or two people did, for the very simple reason that if you physically attack a boat in international waters, and bear in mind that everybody knew that we were nowhere near either Israel or Gaza, we were in international waters, and there was no warning given. There had been communication from the Israeli Navy a few hours earlier, but this attack happened without warning. So people were suddenly assaulted during prayers. They were actually engaged in prayers on the Turkish ship at that time, and they finished the prayers before they got up to actually attempt to defend the ship. I think they were entitled to attempt to fend off the Israeli attack because it was a violent attack. That's the sort of reaction when you punch somebody in the face. There were hundreds of people on that boat. They were almost entirely peaceful in their reaction to the Israeli assault. The Israelis went in with murderous intent. They were the people with the guns. There was nobody else on that ship armed with a gun. They went in there armed to the teeth with live ammunition. So I actually find it very difficult to listen to questions. And with the greatest respect to yourself, I do understand where you're coming from as a journalist. Having heard the reports, though, from people that were on the ship, I find it very difficult to listen to people who suggest that in some way that the Israelis were justified in what they did. This was an appalling massacre. It wasn't even on their own territory. It was carried out in international waters. And then they proceeded to hijack the ships and kidnap hundreds of people and bring them to prisons in their own country. How dare they?
Can you tell us what happened to the mobile phone footage that I presume people on these ships must have taken? I mean, nowadays there's always mobile phone footage, and from what I can see on YouTube and elsewhere, there isn't any. What happened to the pictures people must have taken?
What happened on our ship was replicated elsewhere. The first thing that they went for was to seize control of the ships with the cameras and the sat phones and all forms of communication, including videos and any footage whatsoever was taken, and they took all electronic goods. We were afraid that the Israelis would attack us once we got into Gazan waters. And our defence was based on protecting the journalists on our boat. We had journalists from Australia and we had a journalist from the United States. What we wanted them to do was to try and film the attack, and we would attempt to defend the boat peacefully in such a way that we gave them as much time as possible to hide their footage. I'm happy to say they succeeded in doing that, and the photojournalist from Sydney, she's here in Istanbul now, and she managed to get photographs of the attack on the Turkish ship out. Likewise, the American journalist, I believe, has some footage. So I think in the days and weeks ahead, more footage will emerge to show things from the other perspective. However, there won't be much of it, because it's quite clear that this was an attempt to black out any coverage of what they did.
And that was Fintan Lane speaking there from Istanbul. Well, that's one account, and over the next few days there are likely to be many more. And Rob Walker, one of our correspondents, has been looking at this with a view to making a piece. We'll hear about this tomorrow, when you'll be trying to piece together exactly what did happen, because as ever, there are just such sort of wide variations
indeed
of what people are saying. But you've been speaking to a German doctor who had quite an interesting line.
That's right. I've just been speaking earlier this morning to Matthias Jochim. He's a German doctor. He was on the Turkish ship, the Marmara. That's the big ship where the deaths occurred and most of the injuries. He was below deck treating the wounded when the Israeli soldiers were boarding the ship. And he told me that protesters actually captured some of the Israeli soldiers early on in the assault. I asked him what he'd actually seen.
I saw, for example, they had two Israeli soldiers were brought down, were captured, and they were treated without violence, and after, I don't know when they could leave, but they were not severely injured, and there were no, we would have protested very strongly if someone would hurt or even kill a captured soldier or any soldier. We are a non-violent movement.
So these were two Israeli soldiers who'd been captured by the protesters, by the activists on board the ship?
Yes. I heard three were captured, but I personally only saw two.
And what was the state of those two? Could you see evidence that they'd been beaten in some way?
No. I saw they were shocked, but I think it's a shocking situation, you understand. No? I understood that. But as I saw, they were treated in a fair way. They were captured, but they were not abused.
But they were being restrained, presumably?
Yes.
Well, there we are. I hadn't heard that before, that some of these soldiers were captured.
No, that's right. It was surprising, yeah.
And there's also an audio tape going around, isn't there, I think on YouTube, you know, with some of the audio of the Israeli soldiers?
That's right. There's audio of the Israeli soldiers. This is posted by the IDF on YouTube, one of the many videos posted. It's audio as the Israeli soldiers are going down. It's some of the radio traffic. What that does seem to show is the panic among the commandos as they landed on the ship. And that audio is supplied by the IDF. It includes one point, one of the commandos saying we need to be evacuated. But
Were you surprised that they posted that? Because it sounded like it was showing them under pressure, you know.
I think the aim of posting it must have been to show that they were being attacked as they came down. But what it did seem to illustrate as well, that they were being put into a situation they weren't quite prepared for and didn't expect. And they didn't expect that kind of reception when they hit the ground. Some people have criticised within Israel, the action, saying this was the wrong commando unit to use for Tiller 13, a combat operation, not a policing operation.
What about the guns and who had the guns and all that?
Well, this is a big thing which is disputed, and that testimony from the German doctor in a way highlights the diverging accounts. What the Israelis say is that two guns were taken from commandos, two pistols, and those pistols were then turned on the commandos, and that's why the commandos opened fire, because they came under fire themselves from their own pistols. Now, what we heard there from the German doctor, Matthias Joachim, is that two Israeli soldiers were captured, they were being restrained. One assumes that their weapons had been taken if they were being restrained. What's not clear is what happened to those weapons. As I say, the Israelis say they were used against the protesters. The activists, the protesters on the ship I've spoken to, say that's not true. Weapons weren't used against the commandos.
And tell us what you're doing. It's in tomorrow's... Is it this time tomorrow, really?
It's actually on Saturday, Saturday's News Hour own.
OK, what will you be doing?
Well, I'm trying to piece together all the first-person eyewitness accounts of what happened on the Marmara, speaking to the Israelis and protesters who were on the ship. Because, of course, the Marmara is the ship which is most disputed. That's the one where the deaths occurred.
And as well as that, I'm told, we'll have coverage of the diplomatic aftershocks, and we'll be looking at what this means for Turkey's role on the global stage in a way it's affected Turkish-Israeli relationships, so on, and also the impact it's having on the US. So lots of coverage all coming up this Saturday on NewsHour with Rob Walker, to whom many thanks, and also Julian Marshall. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour. So having tried the obvious methods of plugging the leak, BP now says it could take months to stop the oil flowing. There are fears the spill could end the livelihoods now of local fishermen and a culture that's lasted generations. The BBC's Robin Bresnahan went to a centre in rural Louisiana that has begun offering counselling to fishermen and their families.
So we're walking into our Centre for Wellness and Mental Health. And this is a free public mental health clinic. And we opened it to address a lot of the PTSD, depression, anxiety, and other more severe mental health problems that people in this community are facing post-Katrina and now with the oil spill in the Gulf.
Liz McCartney's phone has been ringing off the hook. She's the co-founder, along with her partner Zach, of the St. Bernard Project. Liz and Zach dropped their jobs in Washington, D.C. after Hurricane Katrina hit. They came to this small community on the outskirts of New Orleans, initially to help rebuild people's homes.
Once we got out and started working on homes, we realized that people were, they were alive, but they weren't living. They were missing this richness in their life. And so we decided if we're going to rebuild people's homes, we have to also make sure that we were rebuilding their lives.
The Center for Wellness and Mental Health opened just over a year ago. And now, with the oil spill, Liz says it's never been busier. Today, a group of fishermen's wives have gathered in a small room to share their worries with one another.
I think everybody needs to talk to somebody. That's how you get through this. You're just on pins and needles till they can say what's going to happen. you know, what are we going to do now? I mean, here I'm 9 months pregnant. How am I going to raise another child, you know, with income? All he knows is fishing.
My name's Yvonne Landry. My husband's probably is depressed. Yeah, he's disgusted with it. Every time he sees the spill and the new tricks that BP is going to try to do to cap it off, it infuriates him. It makes him mad. I'd never get him to talk to anybody. No way. I don't think you get very many of the fishermen to come talk. The wives, maybe. Husbands, I doubt very seriously. If they did, it would be in secret. They wouldn't want the rest of them to know.
But today there is a fisherman here. He's called Roy, and he's come for some advice on insurance at the St. Bernard Project. His crabbing business has been shut down because of the oil spill. He and his wife, LaDonna, say they need all the help they can get.
What's hurting me is we're uncertain about our future. I mean, is my kids going to get to see this? Not just fishing, the animals. You know, I bring my kid out in the marsh, and I show him all the nutrias and the alligators. I ain't going to be able to do that no more, maybe. It hurts me. It's like a death in a family. That's how it feels to me. It's just, I don't know which way to go now, you know. I know it's in my heart to commercial fish, and I know how to do other things, but I can't do other things when this is all I think about. I'm scared.
He's depressed. He's angry at times. I've seen it all. He's not the same. It's hard to see him this way.
Roy says his fishing friends would never come here to see a counselor. To them, it would mean relinquishing their manhoods. And that's why Liz says there's an opportunity to expand the clinic and go to them.
Our goal to assist people in the fishing community is to open up a center out where they are, to hire either men or women to be peer counselors and go out into the community and help people who are really struggling realize that they're not alone, to give people a sense of normalcy and dignity and make sure that they can get back to being self-sufficient and contributing members of their community once again.
And that was Liz McCartney from the St. Bernard Project, ending that report from Robin Bresnahan in Louisiana. Traditionally, the argument about aid to Africa has run like this. What's best for Africa, aid or trade? Answer, trade. But protecting Western producers, especially farmers, means it's better from the West point of view to give aid, and so it has been. Well, a report from the Royal Institute of International Affairs, aka Chatham House, rather turns that argument on its head and says that Europe and North America will lose influence in Africa unless they develop greater trade links. So the West needs the aid. Tom Cargill wrote this report and joins us now. And actually, is Western trade increasing, decreasing, stagnant with Africa?
It's going up a little bit, but it's basically stagnant and has been for some time. In relative terms, it's declining, of course, because certainly until last year, the West had gone through a long period of growth and trading more with other parts of the world. So it would be in their interest to expand trade in Africa, not just to help Africa, but to help their own economies. President Sarkozy just this week said that the future of world growth is going to be in Africa. So it's to help Western markets and Western consumers as much as anything else.
Yeah, some consumers and some Western producers, but not farmers, for example.
Well, I think it would help them in the long term. I think that the current system of subsidies is unrealistic and unsustainable. And if they're only to look at the opportunities that would come from actually opening up the markets in Africa and being able to engage in agricultural productivity there, I think it would be in the interests of Western states as a whole.
One very interesting point you make in your report is that Western countries are reducing their diplomatic presence in Africa while developing countries are increasing theirs.
That's right, and it's not just about economic growth, it's about political influence as well in this changed landscape we're facing post-financial crisis, when the rise of the G20 and the shift in power from west to east is increasingly obvious, that being able to engage with African states, which after all account for 25% of UN General Assembly votes, is going to be increasingly important for countries that wish to have a global influence.
What about the argument that China has a competitive advantage because its government isn't bothered about human rights?
I think there's some truth in that, although I think that China's engagement has been, for the most part, positive. But this is another reason to have a greater Western business involvement and strategic business involvement in Africa, to be able to lend that balance and offer not just the entrepreneurialism and dynamism that comes from China, but also the regulatory environment that will make that sustainable.
If everything you say makes sense, why doesn't it happen?
I think it's starting to happen. I think that there is a cultural perception in the West still, with the overemphasis on humanitarianism and aid. It actively puts off business people, and Africa still seems to remain this some sort of sacred space for many Western governments, set apart from the rest of the world. And it's about time that perception was turned on its head.
Yeah, but companies don't work like that, do they? If they can make a profit, they will.
I think you'd be surprised, actually, the number of business people, senior business people that we talked to when researching this report, who said, you know, we do make a lot of money in Africa, but at board level, our other directors don't seem to recognise that. There's a strange blank spot when it comes to Africa.
But I guess with the colonial history, there must be many African governments and African people who would be absolutely delighted if the West failed, actually, and that they could build relationships with others.
I don't think that's the case. We're seeing increasingly that African states very much welcome emerging powers, not just China, but also Turkey and South Korea and others. But they want a range of partners. They want to be able to increase their leverage, and that means maintaining their relationships with the West as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much for telling us about your report. And that was Tom Cargill, who wrote that report for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House here in London. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. Coming up on NewsHour over the next 30 minutes, why did a taxi driver shoot 12 people in northeast England dead? Why would six men agree to spend 520 days cooped up in a steel container in a car park in Moscow, which is exactly what they have done? And is poker actually a game of luck or skill? You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. Well, another ship is on its way to Gaza to try to break Israel's three-year-old blockade of the Palestinian territory, and the ship is called the Rachel Corrie, carrying 11 passengers, apparently, and could arrive this weekend, maybe early next week. And Israel is saying it will process the aid by land, but not allow these ships through. So let's get more now from the land checkpoints. John Donison is at the Rafah crossing point between Gaza and Egypt, at least nearby, and I spoke to him earlier and began by asking him to describe what it looks like there.
It's a fairly chaotic scene, I should say, not aided by the fact we've got a sandstorm blowing in at the moment, but this is the crossing, the main crossing from Egypt, which you'll know that Egypt decided to open indefinitely to people earlier in the week, which is pretty unusual in itself. And I've seen people coming across carrying great big fridges loaded with suitcases, many people returning from Egypt, many go there for medical treatment, and then they've been allowed to come back laden with goods. But nothing is coming through here, and this is the same road that links to the Kerem Shalom crossing, and that is where Israel had said it was going to be bringing in the aid that was being carried on the Free Gaza flotilla, but have not done so.
Right, so just to be clear about this, the aid is there, is it? I mean, where is the aid?
No, the aid was there. Right. It was brought down from the Israeli port city of Ashdod, and the Israeli government made quite a big thing earlier this week of saying, look, we want the world to see we are taking this aid in. They sent out various press releases trying to assemble camera crews at the crossing and all the rest of it. What we're hearing now is that they have agreed to let in some of the aid, but what they're not letting in is cement, metal girders, that sort of thing, which frankly was made up a huge proportion of the aid on board these ships. Now, what Israel is saying is, look, these are things that have dual use. They say they could be used for military purposes by Hamas to build bunkers, that sort of thing. At the same time, the list of things that Israel does and doesn't allow in is sometimes quite bizarre. So, for example, and let me get this right, cinnamon is allowed in, but coriander is not. jam is allowed in, but marmalade is not. So Israel undoubtedly is restricting goods coming in to try and put pressure on the Hamas government by making lives, people's lives difficult here. Hamas, for their part, they say, well, look, they've said today, if you're going to let this aid come in, we'll take it, but it's all or nothing.
I see. And just to fill us in on the Egyptian side of this as well, because Egypt has participated in this blockade and people find that difficult to understand.
Well, that is because Egypt, or at least the Egyptian government, is no friends of Hamas. Basically, Hamas were formed out of an organisation called the Muslim Brotherhood, which are an outlawed opposition party in Egypt. They're the main opposition party, even though they're deemed illegal over there, and they have pretty major support. So for Egypt's part, they want to put pressure on Hamas as well. And for that reason, they, in effect, have had a blockade of Gaza as well, which sometimes doesn't get that much as much coverage. The fact is, though, Egypt is treading a fine line, because on the one hand, it doesn't want to support Hamas. On the other, it doesn't, as an Arab country, it doesn't want to be seen to be abandoning the Palestinian people. And that's why we have this, frankly, ludicrous situation. There is huge trade between Egypt and Gaza, but it's done underground through illegal smuggling tunnels.
John Donison there. Well, international opinion does seem to be sceptical about the blockade of Gaza. Take, for example, former British Prime Minister and international envoy to the Middle East, Tony Blair.
Look, I've been calling for a change in policy on Gaza to open crossings for goods that should come into Gaza to help the people there for the best part of 2 years. So I don't think it simply is a result of this incident. I just think the policy in Gaza is counterproductive. And what we should be doing is allowing material in that rebuilds homes and sanitation and power and water systems.
And that's Tony Blair. So how do people, though, in Israel see the issue? Well, Gil Hoffman is chief political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, and Adam Keller is spokesman for Gush Shalom, a left-wing Israeli peace activist group. And I spoke with them earlier and began by asking Gil Hoffman how the Israelis felt about the blockade after recent events.
I think it's very interesting to see that in a week in which there was criticism of the Israeli government, both from right and left among the Israeli population in the wake of the raid of the flotilla, I haven't gotten a single statement on my pager, on my or SMSs on my cell phone from anyone calling to remove the blockade. The Israelis are very much united in saying that this blockade must continue in order to prevent missiles from getting into Gaza that could be fired at Israeli civilians, for the betterment of the people of Israel and for the betterment of the people there in Gaza. If there's anything that can be done that maybe would persuade some Israelis to support lifting the blockade, it would be the release of Israel's kidnapped soldier, Gilad Shalit, who's been suffering there now for almost exactly 4 years.
Well, is there any debate of the way it's enforced? I mean, we had this yesterday with UNRWA telling us, and John Donison, our correspondent, making the same point, that things like coriander and pencils and notebooks, you know, sometimes being blocked, and not all, yeah, quite capricious, not all the time being blocked, depending sometimes where they come from. Is there any debate about the way it's enforced?
On that, those kinds of questions are raised and are dealt with, and I understand that it might sound a little bit strange, but I think I'd leave it for people that understand it better than me to be able to decide what goes in and out. Unfortunately, fertilizer and all kinds of weird things have been used to build rockets that were fired at civilians and everything. And if they say that one thing works and one thing doesn't, then I get it. But meanwhile, 30,576 trucks of aid went in 2009, and that doesn't sound like any kind of siege to me. We have to do whatever's necessary in order to protect the security of the people of Israel and eventually the Palestinians in Gaza. They're going to have an election inside the entire Palestinian Authority. The Hamas won't be in charge anymore. There's going to be Palestinian leadership that believes in reaching peace with Israel and not trying to destroy Israel. And then things are going to change for everybody. They're going to have the good economic conditions that the Palestinians in the West Bank have.
Adam Keller, do you think, I mean, the argument being advanced that is that the blockade will persuade the people of Gaza to reject Hamas? Do you think that will work?
I think the blockade is persuading the people of Gaza to support Hamas. because the people of Gaza don't think that the blockade is because of Hamas. They think the blockade is because of Israel, and they think that Hamas is the only group which can give them at least some protection against Israel. And for example, that Hamas is developing the tunnels, which are really the lifeline from which they get something, at least from Egypt. But I want to say about the principle of the thing. I think it is ridiculous, of course, that coriander is not allowed, but I think that is a detail. I think that even if the government of Israel was super liberal and giving the Palestinians caviar every day, that still it is wrong that the government of Israel is the one which decides what goes into Gaza and what doesn't go into Gaza. Just like it is none of the business of the Palestinians what goes into Israel through the port of Haifa or through the port of Ashdod, it should not be the business of Israel what goes into Gaza through the port of Gaza.
Well, let me just challenge that and say, what about the security argument that, you know, things...
I think Palestinians could say that there is, through the port of Gaza, there are coming in tanks through the port of Haifa, there comes in for Israel tanks which bolster the possibility of the Israeli armored corps to make invasions into Gaza. And through the port of Haifa, there come into Israel airplanes which can indeed, just a little bit more than a year ago, bomb Gaza. So I mean, there is no logical reason, in fact, why the import which goes into Israel should not be controlled by anybody, and the imports which go into Gaza should be controlled. The only reason is just that Israel is stronger than the Palestinians. That's the only reason, and I think that is not a sufficient reason. And it is also not helping Israel's future, because now my predecessor said there will soon be elections in Gaza and they will vote for somebody else, vote Hamas out. I want to say that Hamas came in through elections. And okay. the disadvantage of democracy is that you cannot be sure how the voters will vote. I think that it is very possible that when there will be new elections in Gaza, the people will vote again.
Okay, you made many points there. Let me just put one of them to you, Gil Hoffman, because it's not an argument we often hear, that, you know, why is it that Israel's allowed to have an army and the Palestinians aren't?
You know, the future borders of a Palestinian state that will be created will be decided in negotiations. What's happened over the last week has, if anything, made it a lot harder for the more moderate Palestinian leadership that was elected fairly and squarely and not the leadership in Gaza that overthrew the Fatah to come back to the negotiating table. We're going to be seeing George Mitchell coming back in spite of it. And then once they have a state, then they're going to be deciding everything the way Adam Keller wants them to decide it. Until then, we have a temporary situation in which Israel has to do whatever's necessary to keep its security, and that's going to continue to be happening. Just remember, being in Gaza when Israel withdrew, there was a lot of hope before the Hamas overthrew the leadership there that Gaza would become a haven that would teach the world what a Palestinian state could be. And unfortunately, after 10,000 rocket attacks, people saw what a Palestinian state could be.
But I do need to say Hamas was elected. And just to get back to the sort of, you know, the point we were trying to focus in on today, can you think, Gil Hoffman, of a case in history when a siege has moderated opinion of the people being besieged? I mean, it just doesn't sound plausible.
You know, there's a Berlin Wall School of Diplomacy that worked in Germany where people can see how much better the lives of the Palestinians in the West Bank are today than the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza, and they have different leadership. Those things are connected. The West Bank is thriving now economically, and the same thing will happen in Gaza, and the people there are going to force it to happen, just like democracy protesters have around the world.
Okay, let me put that to you, Adam Keller.
Yes. First of all, I have quite a lot of Palestinian friends on the West Bank who would dispute very much the assertion that the West Bank is thriving. I have a friend in Hebron who is a taxi driver and who tells me how difficult it is to find a fare and to find the very bare survival for his family. There are some new buildings going up in Ramallah, which some Palestinians who have a lot of money could benefit from. That is a very, very narrow economic thriving, and I think that the Palestinian economy could really take off only once they have control of their economy. And control of their economy means, first of all, control of the external borders and the decision of the Palestinians to export and import whatever they think fit for their economy. This the Palestinians in the West Bank don't have either.
And that was Adam Keller there and Gil Hoffman. You might think it would be great to go to Mars, except for the fact, of course, that you'd have to spend over a year cooped up in a rather cramped spacecraft. But how would you feel if it was a case of spending the time in the spacecraft without going to Mars? Well, that is what six people have agreed to do. They're going to, in fact, they already have, clamber into this capsule today in a Moscow car park. And their mission, to go boldly, nowhere at all. The idea is to see what happens when you put people in a tin can for such a long time. Well, earlier I spoke to psychologist Jane McCartney and professor in planetary sciences Colin Pillinger, and I put it to Jane McCartney that it seems extraordinary that people would agree to do this.
It is, but it's an interesting experiment. It'll be really fascinating to see actually what happens at the end of 18 months or even at the end of 18 weeks to see what their psychological welfare is like.
Do you think it's safe?
It's safe in as much as when they want to, they can withdraw. You know, I'm sure there must be some sort of clause that they, you know, this isn't jail, they haven't done anything wrong, they're not locked up, and if they really want to, you know, they can bang on the door and they can be let out.
Colin Pillinger, what do you make of it?
Well, eventually it has to be done if we're going to send people to Mars. We need to know the psychological, physiological problems. The technical problems are more concern of me and, you know, their safety and the safety of the world if you take them there and bring them back with some infectious disease.
But you don't think you can send people to Mars without going through this process?
The real thing that would concern me is that we would need to know that whether there is or not life on Mars before we do it, because a microorganism adapted to Martian conditions could be very virulent if you released it on Earth. So you'd really need to know you weren't going to do that.
Yeah, but that's another sort of set of considerations altogether, isn't it, Jane McCartney? I mean, first of all, it's sorting out the astronauts' psychological safety.
It is, and the psychological welfare of a crew of astronauts is critical to absolutely any success of any space mission. It's important to know how people are going to interact with each other, what problems might come up, what can be done if those problems do come up.
Have people done research in prisons to see what, you know, any relevant considerations there, or is it just too different?
I think it's too different. I think you can look at certain similarities, you know, like isolation, enforced isolation, and seeing what that does to somebody. But, you know, we are talking about completely different set of circumstances where one is involuntary and one is voluntary, obviously.
Well, yeah, the submarines, mind you. How long do they spend in submarines?
I'm not too sure, but I think they do actually spend for quite some time. But you've got to remember the submarines as well. There are more people there as well. It's not just six people, and, you know, and the magnification of irritating habits with six people is a little bit more diluted with a big submarine crew.
And Professor Pillinger, just fill us in on the time that any Mars mission would take for these humans to go up and presumably land on Mars and then get back.
Yeah, well, the shortest route that you can take when you're going from Earth to Mars will be about 7 months. However, when you get to Mars, Mars and Earth are in entirely the wrong places in the solar system. So you have to sit on Mars and wait for the bus to come back. And then you have another 7 or 8 months coming back. So at least 18 months, probably 20 months for a round trip.
Well, so how long would you have to wait?
Oh, we have to wait till, you know, Mars goes... The Earth and Mars go around the solar system at different rates. The Earth goes around once every 365 days. And Mars goes around every 654 days. So you have to wait till they're actually on the same side of the solar system. Which means you've got to go, you know, through at least a whole year, and more likely a little bit more.
One last thought, Jane McCartney. Do you think all six will stick it out?
It's possible that they will, because by the fact that this is a sort of like simulated false environment might be the thing that actually encourages them.
And that was Jane McCartney, their psychologist, and Professor Colin Pillinger. The northwest of England is known for its lakes, its steep-sided mountains, small rural communities, and ever since Wordsworth, for its daffodils. It is not known for random drive-by shootings, but that's what happened yesterday when a 52-year-old taxi driver killed 12 people and seriously injured others. The British Home Secretary, or Interior Minister, is Theresa May.
Mass killings, as we saw yesterday, are fortunately extremely rare in our country. But that doesn't make it any the less painful. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't go do everything we can to stop it happening again. So when there are lessons to be learned, we will learn them. And when there are changes to be made, we will make them. But for now, let us wish the injured victims a speedy recovery. Remember the 12 innocent lives that were taken, and pray for the families and friends they leave behind.
So why did this happen? Well, Colin Edgar is the editor of the Whitehaven News, the local paper in the area where the killings took place. And I asked him, what has his newspaper learnt about this individual, Derek Bird?
We're still awaiting quite a lot of confirmation, not only on Mr. Bird, but also on the victims. What we seem to have found is quite mixed reports, really, of the man himself. There's lots of people who knew him for 20 or 30 years, been telling us he was a friendly man who's enjoyed his hobbies, enjoyed going for a drink with his friends. He became a grandfather just 11 days ago, and it sounds from those reports at least that something just in the last few days has tripped him over the edge.
Yeah, because the night before he was sort of saying things which in retrospect were clearly indicating what he was going to do.
That's right. There's some suggestion of an altercation with fellow taxi drivers lined up at a rank. And he did say, or so it's reported, that there's going to be a rampage, you won't see me again.
And an argument about a family will? Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, we do know that one of his victims was a man called Kevin Commons. He's a solicitor in Whitehaven, another very popular man, well-known in the community. There are suggestions that there have been some dispute over Mr. Bird's mother's will. This hasn't been confirmed yet, but we do also know that Mr. Bird's twin brother was among those shot dead.
Right, and just to be clear about the people he killed, it seems that some of them were people known to him, deliberately targeted, but I've read accounts where people just seem to be stopped on the street and shot completely randomly, so it was both.
Absolutely. It seems that the first shootings were the solicitor, his brother, in a village outside Whitehaven, which is here in the northwest of England, and then into Whitehaven itself, and then finally, as he went into villages in lovely rural settings, that's when it seemed to become just random killings. There were cases where he'd wind his window down, we're told, and ask for directions, and people would stop to help him, and then they were shot dead. There was a young rugby player, Gary Purdom, who was working on a farm, and he stopped to ask Mr. Purdom directions, who was shot immediately, and then we're told that Mr. Bird got out of the car and shot him again. This is a man with two young children. He's only 31, is known in the community as a good sportsman and a good man, and it's just staggering. It's beyond belief that a tragedy like this should happen in a quiet area like this.
And then in the end, he abandoned his car, headed for some woodland, and killed himself, right?
Yes. That's right, yes. A very secluded setting. There seemed to be no pattern to the route he took. It's a zigzaggy kind of line down south of Whitehaven, on the fringes of the Lake District, and then finally into this setting where he was found.
Colin Edgar there, and I've also been speaking to Professor Craig Jackson, who's head of psychology at Birmingham City University and a specialist on work-related violence. Is it usual for problems at work to lead to such killings?
Well, there are many incidents of work-related violence that are recorded annually in the UK, but certainly it's very rare for them to culminate in mass spree killings of this nature.
What do you make of what we've heard?
I think one of the interesting things at the moment is that Mr. Bird clearly doesn't fit the usual profile of previous spree killers, both in the UK and in Europe. They tend to be of three types. They're either classified as family annihilators, paramilitary sort of enthusiasts, if you think about Michael Ryan, or they tend to be disgruntled ex-workers. But the thing that's interesting about Mr. Bird is he was clearly socially capable and able and described as being functioning and had friends, unlike Michael Ryan or Thomas Hamilton, who were clearly described as being odd or living with their parents or both who were unemployed at the time. So he doesn't fit that particular bill, but I think there are certain things that have come into place which will have put him under extreme pressure, and that will have culminated in this sort of bizarre sequence of things coming into a line which led to him to do this spree kill.
Yeah, because from what I've read and what we just heard, it just seems a case of monumental frustration with a number of things in his life.
Yeah, nothing has been confirmed by the police. That I've heard reports that he had dealings with the Inland Revenue, that there were work-related issues, as your previous contributor said, about taking his fares. There was problems with family finances. So all of those things could have combined or been on their own to put him under extreme stress and therefore his emotional response. Some people could cope with these events and think about it in a very clinical, measured way. Other people, perhaps like Mr. Bird, are emotional responders, and when they're angry and frustrated and feel no one's listening and no one's helping, and if they have access to weapons and firearms, then you do get this kind of culmination.
And just on the gun control aspect, we have very strict gun control in the UK, but if someone like this has no history of anything, then of course they'll slip through the net.
Well, we're not sure if he does have a history or not. I did hear one rumour that some journalist said that he may have been known to the police. The police haven't confirmed or denied that he was known. And if you do have a criminal record, it does not necessarily preclude you from owning a firearms licence.
And that was Professor Craig Jackson. Now, poker, a game of luck or skill. Bit of both, you might think, but that's not what the Supreme Court in Switzerland says. A new ruling concludes that the card game is chance alone, like roulette and slot machines, and it should be confined to casinos. And that means Swiss players having to pay 50% tax on profits, and it basically means an end to private poker tournaments. And the casino bosses may be happy that the poker's coming to them, but amateur players aren't. And one of them is Paul Chung, at least he plays in the UK mainly, and he's also features editor for Poker Player magazine. So what about the basic question? Poker? Luck or skill?
There are elements of luck involved, but it's predominantly a skill game.
Can you establish that?
I think that poker gets quite a bad reputation because it's found in casinos alongside roulette and slot machines, like you were saying before. Secondly, you need to differentiate between good poker players and bad poker players. Bad poker players, they are going to require more luck than skill to win.
I see, yes.
But the better players, you always see them coming to the top in tournaments. You can't dispute that.
Well, exactly. That seems to be quite clear proof that if the same players are in the top 100, let's say, year after year after year, then that's because they're skillful.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the top 10 tournament earners in the world, those players have been around for 10, 15 years, and they're the same names that just keep coming up time and time again.
Is it because they've got lots of money and they can afford to lose?
I mean, they do have lots of money, but they didn't start off with lots of money. They started off with the same amount of money as the rest of us. I mean, I'll give you another example of this idea that there's more skill than luck. There's quite a famous poker player. Her name is Annette Elbrestad. She's a Norwegian player, and a couple of years ago, she was playing online, and she actually covered her cards with a post-it note or a piece of paper, so she wasn't looking at her cards at all. And she managed to win this tournament just because she was employing all the other techniques that are involved with being a good poker player.
She won without looking at her cards?
Yeah. I think she looked at her cards once, but basically she didn't look at her cards. You know, you've heard the saying that it's more than about the cards, it's about playing the player. I don't know if you've heard that saying. We have that saying in poker. And the cards, literally, you almost don't need to... It doesn't matter what they are. I think when it comes down to it, poker is really about making the best decisions possible. And if you're making the best decisions time and time again, it's basically... It's a no-lose situation. The luck comes in because in one or two tournaments, amateur players can win. But you put them in 100 tournaments and they're going to lose their money.
Sounds plausible. Paul Chung there on poker. That's it. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.